Hi, and welcome to Halfwit History. I'm Jonathan.
And I'm Kylie.
And this is a show where we talk about the upcoming week, but a long time ago.
And sometimes not so long ago.
And this is my week, and it's not so long ago this time.
Well then.
Yeah. So, I'm going to start you off with a story rather than tell you what the topic is right away.
Aw, tease.
Hee-hee-hee. It's the year 2991.
Wait, what?
The Earth has been long destroyed, but life is not dead. Inside a pyramid of glass, you can find a small sample of what used to be. A rainforest, a desert, a swamp, and a small ocean. There are remnants of all sorts of creatures here, and Kylie's making very strange faces at me.
Are you giving me the synopsis for Horizon Zero Dawn?
No, get out of here. But they have mostly been outpaced by a few alpha predators and lots of cockroaches and ants.
Ew.
Moving past the scenery, there are paths that lead to doors, that lead to labs, that lead to living quarters. And in these sterile facilities is where you'll find the skeletons. The crew's bodies laid strewn about, separated from another. There may have been fighting, as some showed signs of injury. Others lay backed against a wall or even in their sleeping quarters. The logbooks state that there were 8 crew members. You realize there are only 7 skeletons inside. That out-of-place mound by the entry must have been a grave of the missing member. These are what remained of the last humans on Earth.
Excuse me?
Except, this wasn't in 2991. It was in 1991.
I think I'd know if the world had ended in 1991. I wouldn't be born yet.
So before we get much further, the crew didn't die. And this may come as a shocker, but they weren't the last humans on Earth.
Ooh.
Mm-hmm. But my topic today is on the first mission of Biosphere 2 that started on September 26th of 1991 and lasted until September 26th of 1993.
I thought you were going to say 1991, and I was like, that was a really short trip.
It was one day. They killed each other. So, Biosphere 2 project was about creating the second fully sustainable biosphere, and it's weird that you would aim to be the second of something, and I didn't remember hearing about any other biosphere projects, but luckily my research didn't have to go too far before the sentence I was reading finished with the planet Earth being the first self-sustaining biosphere.
Ah, I see now.
Yeah. So clever on them. I felt a little dumb after thinking about it so hard while I was reading that sentence.
Before you finished the sentence, you just stopped thinking, and then you go,
Biosphere 2? So, this concept was at least a little important to how Biosphere 2 came to be. The talks about Biosphere 2 started in meetings at Synergia Ranch, and at the time, Counterculture Estate, that focused on agricultural advances using solar and wind energy, among other things, which was started by John P. Allen. Part of John's reasoning for starting the society was to better embody the philosophy of his friend R. Buckminster Fuller, who worked on the ranch's buildings, was influential in its naming, and also popularized the term Spaceship Earth.
Hmm.
The idea behind Spaceship Earth is that all of us on the planet need to start treating Earth as if it were one big vessel, and it was the collective population's job to keep it running optimally as one big crew rocketing through the stars.
All right.
Yeah, I kind of like that philosophy.
I get it, yeah.
We're all in this together is really what it means.
Yeah, I mean, pretty much, yeah.
So, a quick aside, though Fuller is credited with popularizing the term, the idea existed all the way back in 1879.
Wow.
Yeah. That caught me off guard that something called Spaceship Earth kind of existed pre-1900s.
Yeah, that seems really early.
Like, I don't even think science fiction really existed pre-1900s, did it?
Well, I mean, yes, because, like, technically Frankenstein is the first, like, science fiction-y-esque book. But, like, in terms of, like, space travel, I don't think so.
Yeah, so that caught me off guard, too. A lot of things caught me off guard right in the beginning of this. Stuff I wasn't expecting to find.
I'm surprised.
So in 1879, Henry George's book Progress and Poverty mentions something about this. And after Fuller, the most popular use is most definitely sitting at Epcot, which is a giant ball with the ride inside that talks about history and the future of human communication. And when they built Epcot, they named that building Spaceship Earth.
Yep.
So that's probably where most people have heard that term before.
Yes. Yep.
Interestingly, that ball is known as a geodesic dome, which was also popularized by Buckminster Fuller during Expo 67 or the Montreal located World's Fair.
Oh, okay.
So already coming right back around.
Full circle.
Yeah, in a very short period of time here.
Yeah.
We don't normally get to the point this quick.
No.
Also, just kind of fun fact, the oldest geodesic dome is located in Woods Hole, Massachusetts.
Oh, wait. Really?
Yeah.
Huh. All right, I see a trip once COVID's over.
It's not that far away. So I could go on further about how Epcot strongly embodies, or was at least originally designed to embody, the Spaceship Earth mentality. But you could also check back on episode 24, Secrets of Tomorrow, because I did that last year.
Yes. Yes, you did.
So that was a really fun one to do. I would recommend doing that.
Yeah.
But listen to this first. Check that one out later. I like that we're, now that we're over a year in, we can start connecting topics back to stuff that we've already done.
We're playing connect the dots.
Yeah, it's kind of fun.
Yeah.
Also helps with listenership.
Yes.
Interestingly enough, as I'm looking at it now, that's also one of our most popular episodes, is the Secrets of Tomorrow episode.
Oh, hey. I mean, who doesn't love Disney mixed with a little bit of a secret society?
Yeah. So, cool.
It's like the best combo there could be.
Yeah. So back to Biosphere 2. With some innovative minds and big ideas surrounding him, John P. Allen gathered the folks of Synergia Ranch and started gathering funds for their next big project. They secured funding from a businessman looking to invest, and this was Ed... I don't know if it's Ed Bass or Ed Bass.
Nah.
I don't know. I'm going to say Bass. So Bass is now known for the millions he donated to the World Wildlife Fund.
Oh, okay.
The Jane Goodall Institute, as well as many other botanical projects, and as well as being vice chairman of one of the projects.
Cool.
I hope he continues to donate truckloads of money towards conservation, not just because we need it, but because he's also in the top 250th wealthiest people in America, valued at over $2 billion.
Whoa.
So I hope these aren't just tax evasion donations happening.
Oh, well, now that you've said it, I'm worried.
It might not be, but we'll get there. He did good things, regardless
yes,
of
yes,
how much.
Yep.
Yeah, he yep. donated money to good spots.
Yep.
Can't knock him that hard.
Yep.
Donate more, though. Anyways, other members of the business team included Margaret Augustine, Marie Harding, Abigail Alling, Mark Nelson, William F. Dempster, and Norberto Alvarez Romo. In 1987, with a cool $30 million and 40 acres of land, they started building. They ended up making a total of 7 different biomes, ranging from 4,800 square feet to 27,000 square feet, most of which on the larger side of those numbers. There was a rainforest, an ocean with a coral reef,
ooh,
mangrove wetlands, a savanna grassland, a fog desert, and an area focused on agricultural systems and a habitat for the humans who would crew the mission.
Cool.
Yeah, so I wasn't kidding about that in my little fake story there. There was all these little biomes
yeah.
of what remains or what they hope to be able to keep sustainable, even if the Earth somehow undergoes some sort of catastrophe.
Now I'm worried that the people are actually going to die.
I said right in the beginning they don't die.
Oh, okay, okay. Yes. I got distracted by all the skeletons you were talking about.
Yeah. Glad I can weave a tale. So really interesting is the amount of effort that went into ensuring that the biosphere was in fact closed. They had to design extremely heavy-duty seals on all the windows to prevent energy/oxygen leakage so that they could monitor how much oxygen was being built up or escaping naturally. But once they designed the super seals, there was a secondary issue. The seals were too good.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So being located in Oracle, Arizona, not too far from Tucson, meant that there would be major heat changes during the day and night.
Oh, yeah.
So what happens when gases heat up or cool down? They expand and contract.
Oh, no.
And with nowhere to go and about 7.2 million cubic feet of gas, that expansion or contraction could build up immense forces and break the glass dome.
Oops.
And that would just, you know, ruin the experiment, cause lots of people injury, lots of animals injury,
yeah,
all that stuff.
Ooh.
And never mind, like, just the pressure being in there. Like, the pressure change in the dome probably would have hurt the crew and animals just as much as anything that may have broken as a result of it.
Yeah, I can't imagine that that would have been in any way, shape, or form comfortable.
Yeah. So, here's the cool part. In order to combat that, they also built lungs for the building.
What?
Yeah, giant lungs. So, they were buildings that could change in their volume. So as everything heated up, this building, there's a section of the building, the lung would expand, and when it cooled down, the lung would contract, and it would keep the pressure in equilibrium with the pressure outside.
I love it!
Yeah, really neat.
That's so cool!
I thought that was really neat when I saw that, and it really is just it's just another dome that you can kind of see off, and it's a little bit separate from the main facility, but I'm not sure if the actual building itself expands or contracts, or if there's some sort of bladder on the inside that of the structure that expands and contracts with it. But
yeah,
it's a lung. This building breathes.
That's both terrifying and awesome.
So now we're finally caught up to our topic of September 26th. So the mission is starting now. You'll recognize some of the names of the official crew as I go through them, because a few of the investors were also part of the experiment itself. So the crew consisted of Roy Walford, Jane Poynter, Tabor McCollum, Mark Nelson, Sally Silverstone, Abigail Alling, Mark Van Thillo, and Linda Lee. And right away, the experiment was off to a rocky start.
Oh boy.
So during the entirety of the first year, the crew reported that they were constantly hungry. The agricultural biome produced only 83% of a total diet, but was nutrient dense, so they weren't getting sick from being hungry, but...
They were just hungry.
They were hungry.
I could not do that. I get so hangry that, like, they would have kicked me out.
Yeah. You're not the only one, and this crew is not immune to those same feelings.
Oh, good.
So, this was mostly planned, because one of the crew... Roy Walford was responsible for calibrating their diet due to research using diet to extend normal human life expectancy. This is something that he'd worked on prior to coming into the dome. That was kind of his main body of work.
Hmm.
Interestingly, this seemed to actually yield results. But remember, this is a very small scale study. It's just eight people.
Yeah. So,
by the end of their stay, the crew lost approximately 16% of their starting weight and started to show an increase of metabolism, lower cholesterol, and lower blood pressure.
All right, someone needs to stick me in a biodome and only feed me that whatever diet thing
nutrient dense 82% of what you should be eating.
Lock me in and just, like, I'd need to be by myself, though, because I would probably end up murdering anyone who was in there with me.
Yep.
But just, like, lock me in the biodome by myself, do that. And then, like, I'll be set for the wedding. It'll be fine.
Sure. Yeah, that's how that'll work. We can start pretending right now. You're already locked up at home due to the pandemic, so...
That's true, but no one, like, I'm buying the food, and I have no self-control.
Mm-hmm.
I need, like, that closed system where I, like, literally can only eat these things.
We have that closed system. It's called the Freshly boxes that come to our door every day.
Yeah, but those are only six meals. Also, they don't come to our door every day. They come to
our
door once a week.
And then we eat it for most of the days out of the week.
But it's only one meal.
We have to combat this. Back to topic.
Anyway.
Yep. So there could have been other factors that went into all of these things happening anyways, so maybe we shouldn't lock you into a dome. you know, given the drastic changes that the crew underwent subjecting themselves to this lengthy experiment, that may or may not have been completely diet-related weight loss.
That's fair. Yeah.
So while the crew was not the happiest with their diet, it did seem to have a positive impact on their health, which was, you know, something to note. Right. Not only that, but even though the agricultural biome only produced 82% of the diet, it still exceeded the world's most self-reliable community farms by almost five times.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So, like, if you look at places like in Indonesia where they live off the land anyways, the amount that was able to be produced in this biome was five times greater than what a normal self-sustaining community relies on.
Yeah, well, I mean, I would assume that, like, a biome, you would be able to ensure, like, the ideal growing conditions and that kind of thing.
Yeah.
Whereas, like, you know, in nature, you're kind of subject to the whims of nature.
Right. But that did prove part of the experiment, which was that life can survive under a dome.
Yep.
And obviously this, you know, five times as much as per population, because, you know, this is only feeding eight people. It's not feeding like a whole village. So some economy of scale factor could probably be throwing that off as well, just the different ratios. But, you know, it's still a win for the crew, proving that the food sources manufactured in the biome could be self-sustaining. Also a bit of proof that if we wanted to be self-sustaining as a species that inhabits the earth, we likely could be right now. We could probably do that. So that's a bigger experiment for another day, but we might need a biome by then anyways, so not really sure it's a win, but at least we'll likely survive.
I'm just over here trying to think if that, how big was the agricultural dome again? Like, do you remember?
No, I didn't mention. I mean, most of them were around the 14,000 square feet or higher.
And it fed eight people?
Yeah. I mean, it's not just the, I mean, I think the agricultural and the crew domes were some of the smaller ones, actually.
Yeah,
so it was probably 1,400 square feet or under.
I'm just, like, mentally trying to, like, do the math as to, like, how much physical area we would need to do that, based on how many people are in the world, and I'm not sure the earth is big enough.
Interestingly enough, at the very end of this episode, we'll get to something that might actually help that.
Oh, okay, cool. All right, I'll shut up then.
It's a little unrelated to biosphere, but a little bit related.
All right, whatever.
So stress was not limited to the crew either. Many species that were introduced to the project in their respective biomes died or significantly reduced in number pretty rapidly. There were also the issue of at least two invasive insect species, which I mentioned in that little fictitious thing, the cockroaches and ants.
Ah, yes.
Yep.
The things that never seem to die.
Yeah, and because they were not planned on, there was nothing planned to contain them, so they thrived in excess.
Oops.
Which did cause some harm to the plant life and required intervention by the crew in some instances.
Gotcha, yeah. But I could see that.
As we'll get to it, there's a lot of things that happened that the crew needed to intervene, which part of the experiment was to try and not intervene.
Right.
So the death of the species wasn't necessarily unexpected, though, and in some instances it was even planned, which raises some serious ethic questions if you ask me.
Yep.
But the experiment started its biomes with an abundance of different species, knowing full well that in a microhabitat there wouldn't be enough space or competition or room for fight or flight to play out as intended. So over the course of the experiment, some alpha predators in each biome began to stand out, and the crew needed to intervene in some areas there as well to keep the biome functioning as intended, which was a fairly important discovery if this would need to play out in real life.
What's I'm just that over face here for? Thinking about all the poor animals that died.
Yeah, well, probably, I think there were some species that did go extinct under the dome, but most of them just dwindled in numbers and became, you know, like the crew became caretakers to them rather than letting them just free in the biome itself.
Kind of like how pandas can't seem to reproduce in the wild.
Yeah.
Poor pandas.
Well, we also seem to not be able to have them reproduce in zoos either. And kind of a neat aside, in case no one heard that somewhere during the pandemic, because of all the other things that happened. But with no one at zoos, the increase of panda bursts just, like, boomed. So if we just leave the pandas alone.
So they had performance anxiety, basically.
Yeah.
All right.
And, you know, probably being in the wild, the stress of encroaching civilization probably is what was preventing them from populating as well.
So the pandas need their own dome that nothing else exists in.
And they'll be fine.
And they'll live.
Yeah. So the species weren't the only thing that needed regulating. Due to the glass dome structure, sunlight exposure, and moisture created due to thriving plant life, biomes like the Sahara needed to be operational on a seasonal basis, or else they would become something else entirely.
Like a swamp.
Right. And we had a swamp in the biome already, so.
Yeah, I was going to say, you don't need a second one. You already got one.
Yep. Speaking of the thriving plant life, there was a type of plant that did not thrive.
Oh.
And it was trees.
Oh. That's bad.
That's concerning. Trees had a really hard time living in the biome.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's concerning for future prospects, considering they're like some of our biggest oxygen outputters.
We need those.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot. Yeah. Yeah. So the stress that trees face from swaying and creaking in the wind actually strengthens them. And without wind, they become weak and it affects their growth.
Oh.
Yeah. So trees need to sway because it causes like microfractures throughout the whole trunk and the branches, and the microfractures as they continue to grow actually strengthen the tree and allow it to get bigger.
Same deal with like when you like work out and stuff and they're like little micro tears in your muscles.
Yeah.
And they,
it's like the exact same thing. Like they wither without without movement, or what is that word that you call that with muscles? Starts with an A, I think.
Atrophy?
Atrophy, yeah. It's they atrophy like our muscles do without movement.
Yeah. Ooh, or like how the right side of your face will never break again.
Ah ha 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 ha. That's not intentional.
Well,
I think we've mentioned this before, but in case you're listening in reverse order, when I got my wisdom teeth taken out, they shattered my skull. So the right side of my skull is this nice spider web of healed fractures.
So it's very durable now.
Yeah. Anyways, we'll move on in case someone already did hear that.
Or doesn't care.
So a secondary reason that the Sahara needed to be seasonally regulated was that after the first year, it was detected that CO2 was building up in the facility and oxygen was slowly disappearing at a rate of 0.4% per month. And reducing some of the biomass in that biome was able to mitigate some of the CO2 buildup, because the Sahara didn't have all that many oxygen producing life.
Like so. Trees.
Well, yeah. So they tried to mitigate how the Sahara functioned so that it could, you know, help out with the CO2 problem a little bit more.
Gotcha.
So in the rainforest, the abundance of plant life started to actually block out sunlight at a rate of 40 to 50% of what was needed for other plants to flourish and grow below the canopy. Yeah, oops is right.
Oh, no.
And, you know, because it's a rainforest, so it was intended to be moist, and then they just naturally found out that this dome was building up moisture on it at an increased rate that they weren't planning for.
So now you have a forest swamp.
Yeah. Everything's turning to swamps. That's what we're learning here.
What did they think was going to happen when they put a bunch of stuff under glass?
Yeah, well,
in Arizona,
the thing that really makes it happen is the fact that there was no way for any of this moisture to get in or to get out. So
you need like a drain's not the right word, but you need some sort of like ventilation.
But they can't have that because remember, it's a biosphere. We need to pretend that the ventilation is non-existent on the rest of the planet. Yep. In all of these instances, you see that humans become what we call keystone predators, which are predators that cull life in order to keep the life that remains biodiverse, which is overall healthier for the existence of a biome.
Fair enough.
Both under a dome and not under a dome. So what about the humans themselves? Most previous research on confined isolation psychology was limited to scientific crews that worked in Antarctica, but this was one of the first times that we were able to study human behavior with a multitude of varying factors, not just science lab in cold. But just like the older psychological studies, people tended to be predictable and they separated into adversarial factions.
Of course.
So one of the first reasons for the split was about how the experiment should be focused. Should they stay focused on biospheres themselves and their feasibility, or should they be focusing on science that can be done on the biomes or in the biomes that are part of the biosphere and how the interior ecology evolves or devolves? So was it more important for their experiment to be completely contained and prove that biospheres worked, or was it more important to see how to regulate biomes in a biosphere. Mm. That was kind of where the split started coming up with them.
Okay.
Another discussion that came up was, should they be prioritizing the research at all, or just prioritizing surviving, regardless of the impact to the credibility of the science?
Hmm.
Yeah, that's an interesting one to draw lines on.
Hmm. Because if the other option is death, I'm going to go with survival.
Yeah, you know, I think most people would kind of go for that. But when you're part of an experiment that's cost many people millions, maybe you think about, well, do we just see how bad it gets and then call it quits? Or do we just try and live as healthy as we can and then report on the things that we needed to compromise on later?
I guess, like, as long as it doesn't actually result in death directly because of this biome, right.
Yeah.
I guess.
So that latter argument came to a head on February 14th of 1993 when part of the scientific advisory committee relinquished their positions due to internal conflict themselves. So, like,
well, it was Valentine's Day, so clearly they wanted to go on dates and the rest of the group didn't want them to.
The New York Times soon after published an article where it stated, "Now the veneer of credibility, already bruised by allegations of tamper-prone data, secret food caches, and smuggled supplies, has cracked. The two-year experiment in self-sufficiency is starting to look less like science and more like a $150 million stunt."
Ouch.
Yeah, and remember, this is it's still going on. They don't stop until September, so this article came out while they were still in the experiment.
Ouch.
So those rumors about smuggled food that they mentioned had started after one of the crewmates had injured themselves and was brought out of the biosphere prematurely to help with the injury.
Well, don't let that person, like, die because they got hurt when there is medical attention right over there.
Right, so they decided there wasn't an issue with opening the biosphere so that the person could get help. They can always mark that down as an irregularity in the experiment and document it and all that stuff.
Right, yeah.
Especially because they were having issues with keeping oxygen inside of the biome and not having CO2 rise. So if they see a weird spike in data there, it's because they had to get someone out.
Right, yeah.
But what they were worried about is when the person was reintroduced, that one of the factions believed that they brought food in with them, like food caches.
Wouldn't someone have, like, seen that? Like,
maybe, but that's why it's like rumor of secret food caches and people getting annoyed with each other. Remember, all these people are on 82% of a diet after 2 years.
Oh, yeah, because everyone's hangry as heck. All right, I can see why people might be very suspicious.
Yeah, so there were accusations of smuggled food from that incident when the dome opened.
Okay, all right.
You know, maybe the people who were not part of that faction that had the injured person saw that, like, hey, weird, after this person came back, like, these guys are acting a lot less aggressive than normal all that stuff. So it's like, did they bring in food?
They're not as hangry anymore.
Yeah, they're not as agitated as we are right now. Why is that?
Maybe they adapted better.
Uh-huh, possible. But when tensions are high and when you're stuck in a dome, both the opening of the biosphere and the potential of outside interference indeed did also reduce the experiment to potentially just a stunt and render data surrounding that event relatively useless.
Oops.
And, you know, especially, as I mentioned before, if they were monitoring O2 and CO2, there's a lot more uncertainty in what the continued data after that point would tell. Like, they can still mark it as an anomaly, but that doesn't mean that the rest of the biome is going to behave the way it would have before that anomaly.
Right.
So, again, this caused tensions between the factions that lasted for the last few months of the experiment. One thing that was interesting about this factional divide compared to others in history was that neither party tried to sabotage the work of the other.
Huh.
So all of them had a vested interest in keeping the biosphere living, and the teams worked together regularly to keep the environment functional and healthy.
Okay. All right. So, like, basically not cutting off the nose to spite the face.
Right, exactly. So they all realized they still had a job to do. They still had data to collect. They still had animals and plants and an ocean to keep healthy and fluid.
Yeah. Okay.
And they all, you know, just sucked it up, worked together, and got their job done to the best of their ability.
All right.
So yeah, none of them ever gave up on their daily tasks or any of the cooperation that needed to happen. And when the tasks were done, they would separate and finish out their days in separate living quarters for the most part. One crew member, Walford, was quoted as saying, "Appreciation of the value of the biosphere's interconnectedness and interdependency was appreciated both on an everyday beauty and a challenging reality. I don't like some of them, but we were a hell of a team. That was the nature of factionalism. But despite that, we ran the damn thing and we cooperated totally."
All right.
So on September 26th of 1993, the experiment turned stunt was put to an end.
Ah.
Yep. In order to save his massive investment, Ed Bass placed a new investor in control of the project, Steve Bannon. Yes. That's Steve Bannon.
Oh.
Yeah. So I guess Steve Bannon was a like banking investment person back in the 90s. And I'm not going to say before he became a nut, because he probably was always a nut. And we're going to read a little bit about that now, too.
Oh, gosh. All right.
In less than a year from his takeover, the entire science advisory quit.
Yeah. Yep. That sounds about right.
Yep. Saying that there was no hiding, that this was just a ploy at this point and no longer science by any means. It was just money.
Mm-hmm.
Unfortunately, they already started another mission inside when this happened, and a new crew and new orders maintaining the appearance of experimentation, but making sure everything runs at any cost, and just to keep it going for the sake of the investment and money and nothing further.
Ah.
So, two of the original members of the first project that we just talked about even vandalized the biosphere in order to contaminate the more recent experiment. And to try and give the existing crew a reason to escape.
Oh, no!
Yep. Based on how the first experiment went, the first crew knew, with the existing management, that the health of not only the biomass, but the crew, was in danger.
Yikes.
Letting in oxygen by opening doors and shattering windows both removed validity from the experiment and provided the crew with oxygen that they likely desperately needed.
Oh, gosh!
Or at least would have come to need in the future, because they knew that that was an issue in their 3 years there.
And they probably knew that they weren't getting it because of how it was being run now.
Yeah. So they likely didn't care too much about that second crew.
Oh.
So lawsuits obviously followed, and Bannon was eventually removed, and the experiment was out of funding at that point. It needed to find a new home or be demolished, and thankfully it was sold to Columbia University of New York, where it was retired as a biosphere project and transitioned into a general research facility.
Interesting. Okay.
Yeah, so the major change was just that it didn't need to be a completely sealed system anymore, and that they regulated the scrubbing of CO2 and the percent oxygen intake from the external environment to the biosphere.
Right,
so
nice.
So they realized that was the major issue of the existing biosphere and said, screw it, we won't use it as a biosphere. We'll use it as a study of these microbiomes.
Right.
And make sure that everything is healthy externally.
Like in a controlled environment kind of thing.
Yeah, it was definitely a little bit more controlled.
Yeah.
And they allowed for more machinery to help regulate all the different systems that were in there. So it was more of, here's our little microbiomes. Let's see how they survive.
Yeah. Neat.
In 2005, the project was once again deemed a financial burden and was put on the market. It was listed as intending to keep the original biosphere intact and used for research, but the listing also did not forbid real estate investors, condos, and other commercial firms from putting in offers either.
So is there a housing development out there that has like a little like pocket rainforest on the side?
No, because
darn it.
In 2011, or sorry, in 2005, a condo developer did buy it, but they never built on it. Or if they built on it, they built on some of the other 40,000 acres or whatever it was that the place had. I forget what the number was they said.
But you could visit the biosphere, right?
Well, I don't think they ended up doing anything with the land.
Oh, okay.
Because in 2011, they sold their ownership of the land to the University of Arizona.
Oh, okay.
Which then donated or sold off the surrounding land.
Okay.
Not too close, but because I like pictures that I saw didn't have any stuff really that close to it.
Mm-hmm.
But the biosphere is still up and operational today
under
the University of Arizona.
Oh, neat. All right. Oh, man, that would have been so cool to, like, live in your, like, condo association and just have this fully functioning, like, biosphere, like, next door that you could just, like, go visit whenever you want an adventure.
Well, they were all interconnected because, remember, the crew couldn't leave. So right. there was a savanna next to a rainforest next to a... So it was right. one building.
Oh, it was only one building?
Yeah.
Oh. I was envisioning, like, little individual dome worlds.
So, like, it was one building. It had kind of little individual dome worlds, but they were all very close to each other. Because it was many small buildings that were all directly touching. It wasn't, like, corridors going between them.
Okay. Because I was envisioning kind of, like, I don't really know how to, like, describe, but I was literally envisioning, like, a big dome with, like, a little connector tunnel. Big dome!
No, it wasn't like that. There was, like, some of that, but, I mean, it was a lot more densely packed. Like, you wouldn't be able to split up the biomes at all.
Okay, so, like, it was just more of, like, there's a partition between them more so than, like,
right.
a whole... Okay.
Right.
All right. But, I mean, still... It would be really cool to live, like, next door to that and to be able to be like, I'm going to go to, like, the rainforest today.
Yeah. So it is open. The University of Arizona does have space programs that they do for college students. And they do have K-12, like, sleepover camps that happen there so that you can see, like, all the different, like, science that they do.
Can I be a kindergartner again?
No.
And go? Why not?
You can't be a kindergartner again.
But I want to go.
I know you want to go.
I'll cry.
They probably have tours.
I'll cry.
Well, then you'll kind of be like a kindergartner then. You're still too old.
I would very much like to go on a tour of this place.
I think you can.
That would be awesome.
Yeah. So, but they do actually still use it for different experimentation, which, like you kind of asked in the beginning, how are, you know, if there's so much land, how are we actually going to be able to sustain more than 8 people? Well, the thing that they're doing in one of the now defunct lungs of the building is they converted it into a vertical farm.
Ooh.
So everything is in columns, almost like storage, I guess.
Right, yeah.
So that way you have verticality to your farm space, which counters the need for vast swaths of land
that's
to support
really cool.
large populations.
Yeah, that's really cool.
Yeah, and I remember seeing something recently in the news about vertical farming as well. So it's not very... I don't think it's very reliable mm-hmm. right now, not in the ways that they're trying to do it. But I know that they're still researching, and this happens to be one of the places that they research this kind
that's
of
cool.
experimentation.
Yeah, that's really neat.
Yeah, another experiment that they have is to see how soil can evolve over time and how plant life can grow in it, specifically using volcanic soil.
Oh, cool.
So they have volcanic soil, and they have microorganisms and stuff that are kind of in it, and some, I'm assuming, very hardy plants if they can live in that, because volcanic soil, I think, is very... nutrient dense but not easy to grow in. It's mm-hmm. not like very habitable, but
yeah,
like, I think that's what it is. I don't remember. I didn't write it down in my notes. But that's one of the other experiments they're doing there, is how, you know, essentially destroyed land can
regrow. Cool.
And lastly, well, not lastly for them, but lastly for our topic, they also experiment on plant life for farming in regulated rooms that simulate how we would possibly, as space explorers, be able to grow plants as if we were setting up biospheres on Moon or Mars.
Cool.
So that's just another kind of experiment that they're doing in there.
That's neat.
So all of the actual science eventually caught the eye of the original project investor, Ed Bass, and he donated some more millions to keep science happening inside of the flourishing husk of his passion project.
All right, there you go. Yeah, it all comes back around.
Yeah, and he's set up more recurring funds and grants for those who conduct research in the facility.
That's cool.
So who knows? Maybe this well-intentioned debacle called Biosphere 2 will someday be supplementing our space explorers with real science and survivability knowledge. And that's pretty exciting to me.
So it won't be a total loss long term.
I mean, they definitely learned something, like, with, you know, keystone predation. So you absolutely need a predator that can regulate these environments. It's not something that in a small micro biome you can expect species to flourish. It's not enough room for biodiversity. So you do need someone to cull and contain and control. So if we ever did that, any sort of biosphere project on Moon or Mars, we would likely have to employ those kind of tactics while we wait for more permanent terraforming options, because that's pretty much how like terraforming would go about. Is we'd set up many biospheres, and once they got to a certain point, we'd encompass all of those into a new biosphere, and we just keep going until there's like an atmosphere.
Horizon Zero Dawn.
Kylie played that a lot.
Spoiler alert.
That's
like, I need to finish that so badly.
You're very, very close.
I am so close to being done with that. I just need to finish it.
I think that's the first video game that you've played more than I have.
Yes, it is.
Yeah.
100%. Yeah.
Yeah.
I really like it. It's fun.
It is cool. I like watching you play it. Anyways, that's my topic, Biosphere 2.
Woohoo! Yeah. I liked it. That was fun.
Okay, on to our call to action.
Whee!
So you can find us on Facebook and Twitter at Halfwit History. You can go to our website at www.halfwit-history.com, and you can find our Ko-Fi at ko-fi.com/halfwithistory.
And if you want to reach out and contact us, give us some suggestions, let us know how you like it, topic ideas, you can email us at halfwitpod@gmail.com.
Correct. And thank you to the Fishermen for the use of our theme song, Another Day. You can find a link to their show down in our show notes. They don't have a show. You can find a link to their SoundCloud down in our show notes. They're good. Listen to them.
Check them out.
Kylie's dying. Fun fact?
Fun facts. All right. Oh, that's a picture of Bilbo. Hang on.
We can't do that over air. We can't show you pictures of Bilbo over air. But if you email us, maybe we'll send you a picture of Bilbo.
If you email us asking for pictures of Bilbo, boy, howdy, do I have plenty.
He's a beagle corgi mix. He's adorable.
He's derptastic.
He is very derpy. We have been talking a lot about today how he only has maybe one noodle in his brain.
Maybe.
Yeah.
On a good day.
Yeah.
But he used two noodles today.
He did.
He did. I was shocked. Anyway. Okay. So my fun fact. On September 21st, 2004, Green Day releases their album American Idiot in the U.S.
Man, that's really fun for right now, but this is in the past.
Hey now. We're picked this fun fact solely for my gym friend, Amy.
Okay.
Yep, that's 100% it. So, Amy, you're welcome.
Don't want to be an American idiot.
It's also a little too close to home, but anyway.
Yeah. So if you don't know already, we're definitely behind.
Way behind.
If you're a new listener, we are very behind. We're catching up. We're still doing every week, but it's just not on the week it's coming out right now.
We're just, yeah.
Yeah. So it's,
Don't even. Just, it's fine. Let's just go.
There was a big thing that happened in America just now, and that's very fitting.
Thank God. Anyway.
Anyway, my fun fact is on September 21st of 1995, the Hindu milk miracle occurs.
What?
Yep, that's what caught my attention. Looked up a little bit, and it's that there were statues of the Hindu god Ganesh, and they began drinking milk when they were placed in front of its face, like in little spoons.
Wait.
Yep, statues started drinking milk.
Okay. That's creepy.
Something else I learned when I started to look this up because I'm like, this is too weird not to look up and probably not big enough for an individual episode.
Yes.
But basically, people would take little spoons with milk and hold it up to the mouth of the god Ganesha. And it would slowly, the milk would go away from the spoon. And then when someone saw that happen, they went, oh, man, and told everyone else about it. And then there were, like, India shut down.
What?
Like, the country stopped functioning when this happened. Because everyone was just, like, making pilgrimages to, like, different statues to give milk. Because the statues were drinking milk.
Wow.
So I looked it up, and if you watch some of the videos, nearly all of them are statues that are very white. I'm assuming they're either ivory, because I think Ganesha was represented by an elephant. I'm pretty sure that was the same one. I saw some that were like humanoid and some that were elephant looking.
I mean, maybe. I have absolutely no knowledge of Hinduism, so yeah. I'm not going to make any guesses.
So they were holding spoons up to there. They were all white. They're either marble or ivory or something like that. Regardless, they're all white. What's actually happening there is water tension. So, like, the surface tension of the milk when it's placed against the stone kind of gets sucked up to the stone a little bit, and when it does, it starts running down it, just running down it. Like, it's not like they're like pouring it into their mouths. Like, it does look like it's being sucked up,
right?
But
okay,
if you look closely, you know, it's just a white liquid going onto a white surface, and it's kind of spreading out very thinly due to surface tension, so it gave the appearance of it. But if you paid attention to the bottom of the statues, there was clearly milk pooling up at the bottom of these statues.
Hey, I mean, you know, everybody's got to believe in something.
That's
so
right. And we're not going to knock you, that, but yeah, that's what actually happened.
That's interesting. I mean, hey, I'm impressed that like the whole country was like, we're going, like, we don't care about whatever. We're just going to go check this thing out now.
Yeah.
That's cool.
So, yeah, that was our fun facts. Anyways, that's been our show. So, as always, I've been your halfwit.
And I'm your historian.
And we hope you listen next week.
Bye. Since you called another day, baby, please don't call my name. Since you left another man, I feel you won't recognize me. Even if we meet